how China may be replacing the U.S. in the near future. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us from Oslo.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So let me first start with you, if I may, Ray McGovern. We're looking at the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin making these comments about China, of which he has said that, China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S. dominated international order. And then he issues a warning. Washington will not let that happen. And this is while the comments were made when the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, the B-21 Raider. What is the U.S. sending as a message there to China?
The message is that, no one is going to dominate the world except the United States of America. That's our role. That's what we've been doing since World War II, and even more so since the end of the Cold War. Problem is that reality catches up with us. The problem is that the Chinese are going to surpass us economically, and they're working very hard to surpass us militarily. Not only that, more important still is the fact that China and Russia have the equivalence of a mutual alliance to include help should there be military action on either front. So let me just wind up by saying that at Valdai, at a speech, I think it was the 28th of October, and Mr. Putin said, you know, I don't understand. The U.S. is getting into a proxy war with Russia, and he's getting into trouble with China, too, of his own volition. He says, I don't want to misquote him. He said, you know, frankly, I don't know why the United States is doing this. Are they sane? It seems that this runs completely counter to common sense and logic. This is completely crazy. Now, the Russians and the Chinese don't have to be neurotic to worry about the United States. The U.S. strategic documents say, no, we're going to take Russia out first, and then we're going to work against China. Last thing I'll say is simply that the Chinese, you know, they have about four millennia of experience. They've never wanted to be the superpower of the world. They've got enough problems with their 1.4 billion people whom they've brought out of poverty. So the Chinese attitude, if I read it correctly, is can't we just all get together and live together? Why do we have to have a win-lose situation? How about a win-win situation? Problem is, the United States and Joe Biden, in one of his very first speeches, says China is trying to become the dominant superpower. That's not going to happen on my watch. Well, I got news for Joe. It's happening, and it's going to happen even quicker with the Russia-Chinese virtual alliance.
Well, Ray McGovern makes a very good point there, Glenn Deason, about the fact that why does it have to be that route that the U.S. is taking? I mean, you're looking at how, you know, you have this B-21 stealth bomber being unveiled, and obviously the U.S. is sending a military message that it may use military power to maintain its international dominance. Why does the U.S. have to feel like that is the option to take when it comes to China, where China is not looking down that path, although we are seeing more and more that it needs to at least show the U.S. the tools that it has.
Well, because after the Cold War, the United States, it put together a security strategy, a security document, very openly saying that its security was dependent on hegemony. So as long as the U.S. was dominant, hegemonic on a global scale, this would be the foundation for security. So any dispersal of power which reduces the dominance of the U.S. will be seen as a threat. Now, again, before you had U.S. and China, they were believed to be in this peaceful interdependence. The problem was it was never sustainable. It was supposed to be interdependence between, you know, the dominant and the weaker party. But you saw over time that China was producing and saving while the United States was consuming and borrowing. So as a result, China was accruing more and more industrial power, more and more advanced technology, and this ungodly amount of foreign reserves. Meanwhile, we saw the U.S. was losing a lot of productive power and sinking further into debt. So this was unsustainable in many ways. And at some point, this partnership had to collapse because the U.S. became worried about the growing strength of China as it feared that China might dethrone the United States. Well, China became more worried that the United States would then turn to economic and military means to prevent its growth. And this is, at this point, you really needed an agreement where the two big countries could come together and say, listen, the new security system really has to be based on a multipolar format. We can't have this, maintain this unipolar moment of based on U.S. dominance when it's no longer reflected in reality. And again, the United States, it didn't show any interest in this, which is why China began to pursue, you know, technological sovereignty by decoupling from the United States, build its own transportation corridors with this Belt and Road initiatives, develop this financial architecture, new one decoupled from the U.S. with new payment systems and banks, and new trading currencies. And the main reason was China was never offered an equal position, as we saw, for example, with the United States blocking Chinese efforts to get, for example, a greater role within the IMF. So because there was no willingness to convert from this unipolar system based on U.S. global hegemony to a multipolar system, it boils down to a military standoff where the United States is now attempting to build up an alliance system, an Asian NATO, if you will, to weaken China. Again, this would come after the United States is able, or if it's able, to break Russia.
Well, you mentioned the Belt and Road, and Ray McGovern, that is one of the shining track records for Xi Jinping that's still in development and is still a work in progress, of which, it's pretty much as it's been called a grand plan for the world economy. And the ones that subscribe to it along this road, the countries obviously are going to reap the benefits from it. At the same time, you've had the U.S. in the context of the Group of Seven leaders in the latest to say that they have raised $600 billion in private and public funds over 5 years to finance what they are calling, the U.S. president has called it, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment. They made that claim back in June 2022. The year is almost over. I don't think that project is taken off, has it? I didn't see anything on that.
Well, I wish them luck with that. This is all counter to what they see the Chinese succeeding in doing. The Belt and Road Initiative is a major, major deal. And so many countries have become interested in taking part in one way or another. And other countries have sought membership in things like BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, S's for South Africa, group. And the Shanghai Cooperation Council, they're all turning away from what used to be the hegemon. Now, this is very serious because the sophomores, and I again call them sophomores 2 years running since they flunked last year and had to repeat the year, the sophomores advising Joe Biden don't get it. They don't understand that the day is over when the U.S. calls the shots. And the Ukraine mess is just one example of that, where Russia was trying to protect its own core interests in Europe and enroll China in supporting them, to the extent, mind you, that China violated its ground core cornerstone principle of non-interference in the affairs of other countries, non-invasion of other countries, the whole Treaty of Westphalia, okay? What did they do? Well, in early February, when Mr. Putin went up to see Xi Jinping right before the Olympics, actually they launched the Olympics on the 4th of February, Putin said to Xi, and this I don't have in any report, but it's the logic that screams out. He said, Xi, the West is not taking us seriously. My people are being killed. The Russian stock people are being killed, up to 13,000 now in the Donbass. There are Nazis running the Ukrainian government. I think I may have to invade. What do you think? Now, my notion, judging from what ensued, is that Xi Jinping said, well, you mean after the Olympics are over, right? Putin smiled and said, oh, yeah, yeah. The day after the Olympics were over, Russia recognized the two provinces in the Donbass, Lugansk and Donetsk. 3 days later, the invasion. So it's very, very clear to me, when the Chinese sort of condoned that and then offered an exclusion for Russia from the Westphalian principles, and then even, this is important for students of Russia or China, you look at their language, and it went away from Westphalia, non-interference in the affairs of other countries, and it said, we Chinese judge core interests pursuing nations on their own merits. So they carved out an exception for Russia. And why? Well, because they're in this thing together. The U.S. has made it absolutely clear that after they, quote, finish off Russia, China is the next in line. So there's a natural alliance here, the fault mostly of the U.S. and its benighted policies toward each country.
All right. Let's look at, since Ray McGovern there, Glenn Deason, has mentioned Russia, let's put that into the context. Let's have you put it into context for us. When the U.S. Talks about how China is going to take on the world order, it's shifting towards China, or that it's actually threatening the world order, which is a U.S. Dominated world order. But now that's changing, and the U.S. says China is the reason for it. But we can't talk about that unless we also bring in Russia into the picture. Isn't that correct? I mean, one example I'm guessing would be, for example, the BRICS group of countries, where you have China and Russia as part of that. And then there's a whole host of things that entail that, from trade to moving away from the dollar to other things that obviously exclude the U.S. Is that what is bothering, or one reason why the U.S. is bothered by this world order that it's losing its grip on?
Yes, but it's often portrayed incorrectly, because it's not a system where U.S. dominance is replaced with Chinese dominance, because the Chinese doesn't actually have any format for unipolarity. I mean, the United States will probably be the world's last unipolar country, because after the United States, the most you can hope for is a bipolar or multipolar system. So, and again, this has been part of the problem. When the West toppled the government in Ukraine and replaced the Russian-friendly government with this anti-Russian government in 2014, this was around the time when the Chinese had started to put out their China industrial policy, the China 2025, the Belt and Road Initiative, and began to develop all these new financial instruments. Now, this was quite dramatic for Russia, because Russia had effectively a very Western-centric foreign policy. It had dreamt about this greater Europe all the way since the days of Gorbachev. But again, when NATO began to expand, they began to lose some faith. But still, many were hoping that they could gradually be integrated with the West and create some common, inclusive European security architecture. But, the toppling of the government in Ukraine really put that killed that off. And what happened since is a tectonic shift. It's Russia embracing now this, what is called the Greater Eurasian Partnership, in which it seeks closer integrated economy with countries in the East. So China, Iran, India, Pakistan, South Korea, like all of them in the East. And this is quite interesting because China and Russia will obviously not dominate the international economy. It's not powerful in any ways, but it has a good contribution in terms of supporting China's ambition to create a new parallel international architecture. And you now see this because they're developing, you know, parallel technological hubs and new industries decoupled from the American ones, new transportation corridors, sure. New financial architecture with all their banks and payment systems. And this is quite important in many ways. Of course, even if you look in the area of energy, it's quite extraordinary because Russia is a huge energy exporter. China's the main importer, and now they don't want to trade even in dollars anymore. And you see this spearheading a wider global trend, which you see, for example, even Saudi Arabia perhaps now switching away from dollar for its trade. So these two countries together are kind of spearheading a global trend, which you see with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS. Uh-huh. So this is a big problem for Washington if they want to maintain hegemony.
Sure. Well, isn't that part of the world order then? As our guests there mentioned, Ray McGovern, you have Saudi Arabia that announced months ago, of course, at this point, that it is looking at using the yuan in terms of its oil transactions with China. You had actually Israel, a close U.S. ally, that changed a portion of its reserves from dollars to the yuan. And we're seeing these gravitational shifts towards China. And since I mentioned Israel, I do have to mention how a few years back now at this point, but the U.S. issued a harsh warning to Israel and said, don't let the Chinese run high for port. And Israel didn't even let the U.S. actually review or look at high for port to see the influence that China has there. Also taking a look at the EU. The EU does not want to let go of China in terms of its trading partner, and there's a diversion there. Is that part of the world order that the U.S. is losing its grasp on?
Well, it is. The currency factor is big. There was also a danger that the U.S. dollar would decline in this sense, but now it's sort of on steroids with all these countries, some of which you mentioned, switching into local currency and doing bargaining with Russia. What I'd like to emphasize is the bilateral relationship. Let's take annual trade, for example. Now, my first portfolio at CIA was Sino-Soviet relations. They hated each other. China was claiming large portions of Siberia. They were fighting across the riverine border, and the trade, annual trade, was $100 to $200 million a year. What's it going to be next year? $200 billion. Now, my mathematician son tells me, Dad, that's 1,000 times. 1,000 times means a lot. And, of course, they're natural traders, Russia being very rich in natural resources, and China needing those natural resources. So not only are they under threat from what they perceive as a common enemy, but they're naturally adaptable to satisfying the needs and furthering the trade and the wealth of each country or both countries together.
The fact that the U.S. has a military or militaristic approach towards China is not obviously something that's new there, Lindy. So, and I'd like to find out from you, how far do you think the U.S. is going to go when it comes to convincing countries in that part of the world that you know, China is a threat? We know that those countries, many of them are part of these large blocks, trade blocks, that the U.S. is not part of, such as the RCEP, for example. The U.S. is trying to, through the last ASEAN meeting that just occurred, trying to sway these countries into its own sphere. But those ASEAN countries don't want to be in this type of middle ground here. I mean, they want to maintain a middle ground. They don't want to be swayed into U.S. sphere through whatever incentives that the U.S. may be giving it, because after all, they do lots of trade with China. Do you think the U.S. is going to be successful in doing that?
No, not really. And this is quite a different area than from Europe, because in Europe, we already kind of outsourced a lot of our security to the United States. So For this reason, they do have a huge sway here. But in Asia, you don't see this aspect. You don't see this willingness to join an anti-China bloc. So far, the strongest bloc the United States has been trying to build is the Quad, which is the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. But again, the Indians are not really 100% on board with this. And actually, one of the key consequences of this war in Ukraine is Russia's shifting a lot of its oil exports and gas to the east. So India now is a huge consumer of Russian oil. So for this reason, India is actually being pulled closer into a partnership with Russia. So this makes them less likely to want to join any US-led alliance, as this will not only alienate China, but also Russia. So this idea of developing NATO of Asia, I don't think it's going to happen. And simply put, it's not, they don't have an option between two opposing alliances, because it's only the United States that are trying to drag them into an alliance. If you look at the Chinese systems they're trying to build, from the Shanghai Cooperation to BRICS, they're not actually alliances, because alliances are usually country A and B cooperating against country C. But they're not trying to mobilize any countries against the United States. Instead, you see them pulling in actually adversarial countries like India, Pakistan, now Iran, maybe Saudi Arabia. Like, they want to bring all of this together, because this is a system where you seek security with other members instead of the members seeking security against a non-member. So it's not actually an alliance system, which is why the Chinese are even a bit reluctant to call the partnership with Russia an alliance, because that indicates it's aimed against someone. Instead, they say it's more than an alliance, because, again, it's not dependent on any aggressive relationship against a third party. So because of this, I don't think that the countries in the region, they don't want to join any side. And because the Chinese aren't pushing them to join an alliance against Americans, all they have to do is sit this one out. Sure. And again, if you want to ally against China, that would be a huge risk for the countries in Asia. And as you see, besides from Japan and South Korea, you don't even find any countries in the region who wants to join the sanctions against Russia. So okay. If they're not willing to join against Russia, then certainly it's going to be a hard sell to try to set them up as proxies against the Chinese.
So, Ray McGovern, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. standing, in a matter of speaking? Looking at Latin America, we know that many of those countries are trying to shy away somewhat from the U.S., from what we're seeing in terms of the ones that are being elected. I don't know if you want to call them far right or what you want to call them, but the latest one being Brazil's Lula da Silva, who said, for example, that he wants to have a currency in order to not rely on the dollar or be captive to the dollar. You're looking at Africa, where the U.S. has fallen behind. Well, we've seen what the U.S. has done to Europe in terms of the war in Ukraine and, of course, its allies there, and, of course, then the East. So where hasn't the U.S. already fallen behind then, and therefore they don't have many options out there?
You asked the right question. What has happened is this unipolar position that the U.S. used to occupy, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, has dissipated. And under the strain of the Ukraine conflict, where the U.S. has not so smartly tried to isolate Russia, not only does the U.S. lose its unipolar position, but it drives the other two main rivals together. Not only is the U.S. not isolating Russia, it's isolating the U.S. and the lily white West. Let me make a point about that. Look at NATO. It's all lily white. Look at China, look at India, look at Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or Latin America, what you just meant. They're not so white. They're people of color. So instead of isolating Russia, what we have done is created a new, I call it bipolar, you can call it multipolar if you like, but it's really bipolar in both senses of the word, okay? It's the lily white West against people of color, Russia included, since it's been blackened so much, it's been pretty much, most of them, a lot of them are people of color anyway. That's really dangerous. That puts the world in a schism that if the U.S. doesn't realize that its predominance has ended, that unipolar world is forby, gone, okay, then they're going to act in very rash ways to defend this thing. And that's what scares me, because the people, the sophomores advising Biden, don't know which end is up. They still think that the U.S. is not only, indispensable as well as exceptional, and they can't get it through their heads that day is over.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Ray McGovern, we appreciate it. Former CIA analyst there from Raleigh, North Carolina. Glenn Deason, a pleasure. Professor of Political Science at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikael Vitakvej and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Idh qala lahum akhuhum Nuhun ala tattaqun.
When their brother Noah said to them, Will you not fear Allah?
Inni lakum rasulun amin.
Indeed, I am to you a trustworthy messenger.
Fattaqullaha wa ati'un.
So fear Allah and obey me.
Dear listeners, we have reached the 107th verse of Surah Ash-Shu'ara, in which the Holy Quran states, كَذَّبَتْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٍ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ So be in awe of Allah and obey me. From these verses, the story of Prophet Noah and his invitation of people to monotheism starts. Now, from the beginning of this journey, he tries to awaken the conscience of the people by proposing an important question. أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ Now, since one of the important conditions, one of the prerequisites for the one who is inviting people to religion of the Almighty Allah is that people accept his words and accept him as trustworthy man, he introduces himself. Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger. Inni lakum rasulun amin. Now, this statement shows that Noah had a long and continued background of honesty among his people. Otherwise, he couldn't have been called Ahuhum in the verse, and people did not accept him as one of their brothers. So people used to know him with his very decent quality. So he says for this reason, he is trustworthy in conveying the divine mission, and they would never see any treachery in it. He first introduces himself. He reminds them that I have lived among you. You have known me for a long time, that I cannot be but trustworthy even in conveying the mission of my Lord, so you need to accept my invitation. إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحْ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So as you can see, dear listeners, sometimes introducing yourself for the people, somehow praising yourself, this cannot be somehow called self-compliment. Because sometimes the people need to be reminded of what is truly happening before their eyes. So at first he awakens the people with this question, أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ? He reminds them of his situation and how he has lived among them. إِنِّي رَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. And at the next stage he says, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ. So, be in awe of Allah and obey me. The Quranic phrase, ittaqullah, be in awe of Allah, fear of Allah, has occurred prior to ati'un and obey me in this verse. It might be for this reason that it wants to tell us that there will not exist any obedience from the Messenger of Allah unless there is faith in being in awe of Allah. I mean, if you do not accept the Almighty Allah, if you do not believe in monotheism at first, you will not be the one who will follow the teachings and orders of his prophets as well. So you need to be believing in the Lord of the worlds at first, and then you can start to follow the Prophet of the Almighty Allah. So, this system of invitation of the Prophet for the people is somehow new. First, he was from among the people. Then He reminds them that I am trustworthy and you can trust me that I am conveying this mission from my Lord to you without any treachery. And then he reminds them again of the contents of invitation. You need to know Allah, you need to be in awe of him, and you need to obey me as a result of believing in the Lord of the worlds. We will continue the story of Prophet Noah and his people in the next episodes, God willing. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here, transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war.
This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arranged for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold, on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action.
The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the Safe Trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, Wee Wang, South Korea.
Yemen is on the road to achieving self-sufficiency, with government plans and strategies aimed at doubling and expanding Yemeni agriculture and local food production. On this trip to a Yemeni farmland, I am accompanied by Wajih Al-Mutawakkil. The man is in charge of vegetable production in Yemen. Al-Mutawakkil is one of the government officials leading the campaign to revive Yemen's rich agriculture. He is here to show us the agricultural projects the government is funding.
We are now on the outskirts of Sana'a, right behind Sana'a International Airport, and beyond this point is where Yemen's agricultural renaissance is beginning to take place. Here, there's farmers that are planting crops such as garlic, onions, barley, and wheat. And these are crops that are vital to keeping the Yemeni economy afloat and keeping Yemenis from going hungry during this strangling economic blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
One of the ways to counter food shortage in Yemen is through the launch of water-based greenhouse projects.
These are the greenhouse projects we launched. There are about 8 on this farm. These are water-based greenhouse, which means we plant crops using gravel instead of soil. This gravel is extracted from the Yemeni mountains. This greenhouse project is made up of organic natural materials found only in Yemen.
Outside of these gas houses is an even more vital crop being harvested in acres of land that stretch beyond the horizon. Yemeni wheat. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, Yemen imports an estimated 4 million tons of wheat a year from foreign countries. To achieve self-sufficiency status, Yemen must produce its own wheat in order to eliminate its dependency on foreign imports. Farmers on the outskirts of the Yemeni capital are answering the call to produce more wheat.
This portion of the wheat is ready to be reaped, while the rest of the field is going to take another week to a week and a half before it is ready.
I like to take the wheat and grind it with my hands. Then I blow away the flax, and now it's ready for consumption.
As food production increases, many organizations have been formed to help achieve food security. Huan Foundation for Development in Agriculture is one of them. Huan Foundation educates Yemenis on the importance of helping the advance of the nation through agricultural initiatives. Huan also specializes in the production of basic foods from a combination of Yemeni seeds and grains at their local factory. They have even started their own brand of flour and healthy snacks sold in and out of the country. Guan's president believes that Yemen's high-quality agriculture must be revived in order to provide healthy food options for Yemenis and to eradicate some of the diseases caused by imported foods.
International organizations are playing and have played a large role in destroying Yemeni agriculture. They did so by exporting grain and wheat to us, which is often rotten and contains harmful substances like chemicals. Additionally, these grain shipments that enter Yemen have passed their expiration date, which results in a lot of illnesses.
After the revolution of September 21st in 2014, achieving self-sufficiency in Yemen is no longer an impossible task. According to Yemen's Ministry of Agriculture, if local food production continues to increase, Yemen could reach food security in just a few years.
The revolution against Western hegemony in Yemen was a starting point towards achieving self-sufficiency, which according to the Ansarullah leader is essential in order to secure food provisions for Yemenis. Yusuf Maudi, The Outskirts of the Yemeni Capital.
A chill has fallen on relations between Moscow and the Vatican City. The rift has been sparked by an interview published in a U.S. magazine on Monday in which the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, condemned, quote, the cruelty of some minority groups of soldiers, namely the Chechens and the Siberian Buryats, in the Ukraine's conflict. On Tuesday, Moscow's ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdiiv, lodged an official complaint in response. Pope Francis' remarks were made during an interview with America, a Jesuit magazine headquartered in New York. When asked about his apparent reluctance to directly condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine, the pontiff said in response that he received much information about the cruelty of the troops. The Russian ambassador to the Holy See, Avdiiv, expressed anger at the pontiff's, quote, insinuation of alleged atrocities by the Russian military during the course of the special military operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also stressed that nothing can shake the cohesion and unity of the multinational Russian people. The Russian Foreign Ministry also dismissed Pope Francis' comments.
What will the Vatican tell us about the martyrdom of the multinational Soviet people? Maybe it makes sense to first discuss Catholic penance for the 20th century for the Orthodox and for Muslims for the many centuries before that. This is no longer Russophobia. It's a perversion of the truth on a level I can't even name.
Earlier this week, Moscow had welcomed the Vatican's announcement of mediation to bring an end to the Russian-Ukrainian war. Some fear that this could no longer be viable after this diplomatic incident.
I don't think this tense moment will change the Vatican-Russia relations substantially. Moscow still expects the Holy See to position itself as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. But whether the mediation takes off will very much depend on Kiev and largely on the U.S.
On Sunday, top Vatican diplomat Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher had said the Holy See and Pope Francis are ready to provide space for peace negotiations on Ukraine. However, after the announcement, Moscow said Kiev is against any peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
Economists believe the world is heading towards an economic recession with the misguided policies of the United States and Europe in raising interest rates. The United Nations has criticized the United States and European countries that have adopted raising interest rates as a way of dealing with high prices and rising inflation. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Agence France-Presse news agency writes, the U.S. Federal Reserve is pegged to make a fourth straight steep hike in the key interest rate in coming days, as it battles surging costs, with its aggressive stance fueling expectations of a recession. American households have been squeezed by soaring consumer prices, propelling economic issues to the top spot among voter concerns in the upcoming midterm elections. U.S. Federal Reserve officials walk a tightrope to try and rein in prices while avoiding a downturn. To raise borrowing costs and cool demand, the U.S. central bank has already cranked up the benchmark lending rate 5 times this year, including 3 straight, 3/4 percentage point raises. But with persistently high inflation and a tight labor market supporting wages and spending, analysts say another 3/4 percentage point hike is almost certain as at the central bank's next policy meeting. The policy-setting Federal Open Market Committee started its 2-day policy meeting